When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to Tell Me Tales podcast. Thanks for joining me for another week. Thanks for the download. Thanks for showing your support for the show. Hopefully you get something out of this conversation and it keeps you company if you're out there running, or it gives you a bit of an insight into somebody else's story and somebody else's life, which I think it will definitely do this week. This week's conversation is with Pat Smith, and it's quite heavy. If you're a kid, turn it off now. You probably don't need to listen to this if you're under 16 years old. Pretty adult themes in there, pretty heavy stories about drug use, pretty heavy stories about the drug world and what happens within the drug world, and how you can be an elite runner before entering that world and afterwards, and those addictive personalities that lead you down that road and into that world. I was very apprehensive about recording this show, and Pat was as well. We've been speaking since Feb, so it wasn't just a show that we recorded just off the top of our heads and kind of got together. We've been having conversations for a while, and we both felt the time was right. I wasn't putting pressure on him, he wasn't putting pressure on me to come on, but I really thought there was something in sharing this story, and supporting Pat in being a male and talking about the struggles he's had in life. And I think when someone comes to you and wants to do that, I think it's going to help them out a lot in the long run, and hopefully you guys do as well. Pat shares his story about his junior days, pretty elite national level tennis player, kind of the hard road that he had through there, and then his involvement in sport. You know, he's an 8-17 guy. He's represented Australia at the Melbourne World Challenge, was one of our runners there, against some pretty handy Kenyans and Africans and Ethiopians and all that stuff. And then, entered the drug world, I guess, and things changed pretty dramatically in Pat's life, and now he's on the other side of it, and hopefully he's on the other side of it for a while. And at no means did I want to put this show out to celebrate that Pat's been in that world and is now out of it, because I definitely don't think, you guys know my views about society and what I value in life. You've heard me talk enough on this podcast about what's important to me, and that world definitely isn't important to me at all. But I thought there was a story there, and a man needed to tell his story, and I thought I could support him in telling his story. If it's not your cup of tea, turn it off. If you want to reach out to Pat afterwards, he lists his handles and stuff there. But enjoy, I guess, this story with Pat Smith. It's an interesting Tell Me Your Tales. It goes for just over an hour 15, and it goes all over the place into a world and into some stories that are new to me. So thanks, guys. Enjoy. Okay, Pat Smith, welcome to Tell Me Your Tales podcast. Thanks for giving up a bit of time on a Saturday afternoon after a busy morning and day at work.
Cheers, mate. Thanks for having me. Thanks for having me on board.
Been a busy day in the cafe industry, right?
Yeah, no, not a busy day for me. I'm as anyone that knows me, I love an early finish. So just a little 4.5 hour shift today. So that works out well for me.
Yeah, nice. And where are we talking to you from today? Where are you, Hobart?
No, just in Lonnie. Home.
I wasn't sure. Yeah, yeah. Because last time I saw you, we were just talking about off air, was when you smashed me at Run the Bridge in January this year. I remember running down the bridge with you, and then I reckon you put in about 35 seconds into me in those last 2Ks. You were flying that day.
Yeah, I don't know about 35 seconds. What did you end up running? You were 31:20.
Yeah, I think 15 or somewhere like that. Did you dip under? Did you dip under 31?
I think I was 30:58 or something. So you had me in sight, mate. Any longer and you would have had me, I was starting to tire real bad.
Oh no, I was gone at 8K. It felt like 35 seconds. I was just hanging on for dear life. And then when we had to do that U-turn at like 9.5K, and yeah, that wasn't much fun at all.
Yeah, I kept looking at the watch, and I know Josh had been his marathon trainer. He'd been running earlier, and as I turned that corner, he was getting that much closer to me. And I reckon if that last hill had been 50 meters longer, he would have had me, because you just couldn't see when it was going to give you the U turn. It just kept going up and up, and yeah, no, I didn't enjoy that last K. It should have been a 9K race for me.
I said that same thing to him. I'm like, before the race, if you go past me, I've had a bad day. And I could hear these footsteps coming up at me at 9K. And sure enough, it was just him floating past me after doing about 20K that morning.
Nah, do you reckon you'll do it again next year?
Oh, I think so. It's a good race. It's well organised and stuff. But the town I live in, we have no hills. Like, literally, there's not one hill within, 25K. So I just get kind of no hill strength throughout the... just the easy jogs or hill reps or long runs, just everything's on the flat. So when I go down there to race that course, it just busted me up big time and just feels super weak, and it just takes its toll a bit.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think I probably should train a little bit more hills, because everything in Launceston's hilly. Have you ever been down to Lonnie?
Yeah, I have done the Launceston 10 maybe 3 times. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, there's plenty of hills around here. So if I do it next year, I'll probably have to do a little bit more hill training, because... Yeah, we're about 3K in, we go up Rosny, and that ruined me. I just did not, even driving in, let you see how steep it is, but when you're running, it's just so much worse. That killed me. So I think this time around, if I have a crack at it, I'll definitely do something hill-specific, because I'm sure it'd definitely help.
Yeah, you're right. And that was the one to get onto the bridge, wasn't it? Like, it just kept going.
It was the never-ending hill.
You look at your watch and it's telling you you're going like 3:35K pace, and you're just getting depresso as.
I saw, I think it was Jack Rayner uploaded on Strava, and he averaged 3:20s up that segment. And I was just thinking, geez, like those boys, like that'd be like equivalent of like 2:50, 2:55 pace on the flat, you'd have to say, because it's a nasty gradient. I think guys on bikes would find that hard.
Tassie do a good job of that, though, don't they? Putting on good races like that one in Launceston 10 in your hometown, and the Burnie 10. Like, have you ran most of them?
Yeah, I haven't done Lonnie for quite a few years, and I haven't done Burnie since about 08. So I definitely, if I can sort of get myself on track and enjoy it, I'd like to do all three next year. Because, yeah, they're just well run, and it's just a nice community day, and the weather's usually good. And I mean, especially Lonnie's a flat, fast course, and then Burnie's got that little bit of a headwind usually on the way back. But I mean, even with the bridge race, what Dave McNeil broke 29 minutes last year. So
yeah,
all three are quick, you know, fast courses, and they're all a bit different, which is nice. You want that. You don't just want that same sort of, you know, flat course. You want something with a hill or a downhill. And yeah, just three really good spots of Tassie, really.
And then I think you've got a good next kind of step down races as well, like the City to Casino and Point to Pinnacle, like races that locals can actually win rather than just get beaten by these big dogs that come into town for the weekend.
Yeah, that's right. All those pro runners just come down for the checkbook, and it leaves
cash up. Guys.
Yeah, it makes us look pretty average when they put 30 seconds to a minute in us over a 30-minute race. But, yeah, I haven't done the full City Casino. I won the 7K a few years ago, and I really enjoyed that, because you start at the bottom of this hill, and once you sort of get over that first little hill and then up into Sandy Bay, it's all downhill, so that was a good run. And then Point to Pinnacle, that doesn't interest me in the slightest. anything over 5K, and I'm sort of – yeah, I'm hitting the off button, to be honest, mate. So I've got a few mates, Joshy Harris and Dylan, that have done it, and Dougie Hammerlock, and yeah, a lot of admiration for those blokes, because racing 80 minutes plus uphill doesn't interest me in the slightest.
Doesn't float your boat, yeah. Hey, mate, do you mind? We just had a massive 4-minute conversation about a few Tasmanian races, but we better let the listeners know who you are and what you're all about. So I always get the guests to introduce themselves. So over to you. Take that however way you want to.
Yeah, cheers, mate. I guess Pat Smith or Patty Smith or Patrick, or however people know me. Yeah, I guess I'm 26. I've done athletics on and off since I was about 16 after switching over from tennis. Yeah, I love my running, and you know, I've sort of found myself just mixed up with, you know, a lot of personal issues, a lot of drug use and depression and things like that. And I've sort of just wanted to talk to yourself, mate, and just sort of get it off the chest and get it out in the open and just sort of, I guess, talk about where I sort of see myself heading now and yeah, just sort of have a bit of a chat and just sort of get my life back on track, to be honest, mate.
Yeah, well, thanks for your time. And it's an interesting one talking to someone with your experiences, because it's you're not sometimes really sure what direction to take it in. And at the same time, I understand how important it is for people to talk about their issues and get it all out there. And kind of, I think when you're pretty brave kind of putting some of this stuff out to the general public, and there's going to be people all over Australia and all over the world that are going to listen to this. So hats off to you for that. But at the same time, yeah, it's an interesting one, I guess, with the way people support it and the way we kind of go about the conversation. We've been playing phone tag for a while now, trying to organise this for a long period of time. And with the ups and downs that come with life, it's been a bit tricky. And I probably could have spoken to you, I don't know, any time over the last 6 months, and I could have possibly got a different story at any time.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't want to talk to you until I felt I was confident I was in the right headspace. And I mean, after Run the Bridge, I was, and things were going well. But I guess as we talk to, you know, a little bit further, you'll sort of see, I guess, just how things can change quickly and how the mindset changes. And I just felt that if I was going to talk to you, I wanted to talk to you when I felt like I was on the right path that I could stick at it for. You know, being someone, I guess, with a drug problem and being a drug addict, you sort of get yourself clean for 4 months, and then, you know, you slip up, and then that sort of throws you off for another two or three, and then you start all over again. So I guess I just didn't really want to talk about it until I felt like I was on the right track and that I was confident that, you know, I can keep it up this time. You know, there's no point chatting to you and saying I'm sorry about these things or this has happened, and then next week I'm off taking drugs. You know, it just wouldn't sort of sit right with me. So yeah, I just felt like, you know, we'll chat when I'm in a good headspace. And at the moment, I really am. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I guess it's that sense of accountability in a way, isn't it? Like, by you naming this and naming it to quite a few, you know, 1,000 people, it's going to get a few people in your corner. And it's also going to give you a few people that you don't want to let down to go back to that world.
Yeah, no, definitely. You know, I guess when these sort of things happen and, you know, you sort of, for a long time I shied away from it. I didn't want to talk about it. And, you know, if people asked about it, or, you know, I had a lot of support from family and friends, but, you know, a lot of other people that sort of would have, you know, within the athletics community and friends of friends that sort of would have thought, oh, you know, what's going on with this guy? And he's very up and down. And I just sort of felt like I had this bit of a monkey on my back. And I just wanted to sort of tell it out in the open and say how it is. And, you know, it might upset a few people, but, you know, if I'm trying to do the right thing and get myself on track, it's better than continuing to do the wrong thing. So, yeah.
Do you reckon as men we got better at that as well, like actually getting our story out there and letting people know when you're struggling and kind of sharing more about personal issues and getting them out there in the open?
Sorry, mate.
Yeah, I'm still there. You just cut out. Well, I might have just cut out. But did you hear my question, mate? That's okay. I can go back and edit this. So if you just want to answer that question from now, I'll cut out the middle bit.
Yeah, perfect. No, I think definitely as a society, there's a lot of things, especially social media, and a big movement against depression and suicide awareness and speaking up about how you feel and, you know, women's rights and just a whole movement of, I guess, people being a little bit more comfortable talking about their feelings and saying if you're not okay. It's, you know, whereas a long time ago, I guess in my dad's era and probably your era when you were a little bit younger, you know, it wasn't the thing to do. It wasn't, you know, you don't talk about your feelings, you just get on with it. And I guess as a society, we've seen that doesn't work. And, you know, unless you're actively talking about it or you're seeking help, if these things go unnoticed, you know, you tend not to get better. So, yeah, definitely a movement to support that sort of that cause.
Mm. And yeah, I was just, when I was talking to Andy Allison the other week, like the whole Movember movement, and I know they were down at Point to Pinnacle doing like the Mobro section and kind of all these new initiatives that have started off. It's must be very, I guess, not so much rewarding, but very encouraging for you to know there's a lot of people to support you in this situation.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm very lucky. I mean, from a family side of things, I've had more support probably than I've deserved, to be honest, mate. But I've also had a lot of support from really close friends, and mates, and yeah, other people that are just acquaintances. And yeah, when you know that, you know, you can come out and talk about something and there's someone there to support you, it does make you feel a little bit more confident about speaking up about it, and you don't feel like you're going to get ridiculed or, you know, shamed or anything like that. So yeah, definitely helpful.
Take me back to the start with the sport, mate. So you touched on, you know, playing tennis at a pretty high level and then the transition over to running. So obviously you're a pretty gifted individual in more than one sport.
Yeah, I mean, tennis was probably my first love, tennis and basketball. I did athletics on and off through primary school. I think I did one season of Little Aths, but tennis was sort of the first sport I took seriously. So probably from about 11 years old to I was about 15, I was fairly full on. So a lot of lessons, a lot of tournaments and squads and all that sort of thing. And yeah, I really loved my tennis, but there was, I guess, you know, a few things that went on within tennis when I was younger that just sort of turned me against it. I ended up hating tennis for a while. I'm actually a tennis coach now, so it's changed. I'm back sort of loving it. But yeah, once things with tennis sort of started to go downhill, I made the switch to athletics at about 16.
Can I stop you there, mate? Only because I've read Agassi's book and just the way he was brought up in the tennis world and just how kind of cutthroat and stuff it is. What do you mean that a couple of things really turned you off it?
Yeah, I mean, I was never pressured in the same way that he was. You got a lot of family pressure and that sort of thing. For me, growing up within the sport, like I played school tennis at a young age, and I've always been someone, I guess, it's pretty a little bit emotional maybe. I wear my heart on my sleeve, and, you know, I wasn't vocally, you know, aggressive or anything like that, but I was hard on myself. And I remember once I was playing school tennis and I lost a really tight match to the number one player at the other school, and the PE teacher, you know, came up and told my parents that, you know, why can't Pat be more like this other kid who was, you know, the number two player? I won't name names. And, you know, I remember saying to mum and dad, like, you know, I'm 10 years old, I don't even know who I am, and this PE teacher is telling me to be more like someone else. You know, I found that quite hurtful. And then continuing to play the sport, I sort of grew up, I guess, playing against kids that are a little bit older than me, and I was sort of a little bit better than the kids my age, so I'd play against the older ones. And when you're up and coming in the sport and you're someone, I guess, that wears your heart in your sleeve and, you know, you give your best, that can sort of either people, you know, with you or against you. And I had quite a fair bit of bullying in tennis. Got to the point where I actually, that we had a state squad, 8 kids in the north, 8 kids in the south, and the 7 other kids in the north, one of them being my best friend at the time and my doubles partner, all said they wouldn't play in the squad if I was in it. You know, that really hurt. Yeah, and I tried to speak to my coach about it at the time. He was the state coach and also my private coach, and he actually said to me and mum and dad, it's nothing that I've done, it's just that these particular kids don't like you and they won't participate in the squad if you're in it. You know, when that's your best friend and your doubles partner and you have to end up traveling down to Hobart twice a week, you know, 5-hour return trip plus the squad, you know, you start to feel, I guess, a little bit, you know, is it, you know, what's wrong with me? Why don't people like me? And that was really tough to take. I mean, I was only about 14 at the time, and that hurt a lot. And yeah, sort of going to tournaments and playing, and it's pretty cutthroat at a national sort of level. And you know, you don't win. And you know, tennis is one of those sports where there's only one winner and one loser. So you know, it's a little bit hard to take. And you know, I get sort of 40, 50 kids sort of booing me, and you know, and these are kids that I'm meant to be going away on the same team as to represent the state, and they're cheering for a kid they haven't even met, you know. So I think that really set me on like the path, I guess, of feeling like I don't live up, and that this sort of pressure I put on myself probably stemmed from that.
Yeah, what do you put that down to? Like, did you have obviously issues with those kids or a bit of tension, or like why were they ganging up on you?
Yeah, I mean, you probably have to ask them, I guess, yeah. Mate, but I mean, we had a kid that I actually played against that was being billeted by them, and I played a tournament in Hobart, and I was beating this kid. I think I won first set 6-3, and I was 5-2 up in the second, and all the kids came along and the booing and that, ended up losing in a tight 3-setter, and played him in another tournament up north a week later, late at night, and there was no one watching, and I beat him 11-3. So it just sort of, I guess, shows that, you know, how much the pressure of tennis can get to you. And this time I ended up speaking to mum about it and just sort of saying, you know, it just shows how much, you know, pressure's around and how much worse I play when I've got this sort of these people that are booing me and stuff. And the kid actually asked them why they bully me, and the reasons they came up with was that I wore my hat back to front and I had the same racket as Leighton Hewitt. So, yeah, it's things like
tall
that.
Tall poppy syndrome, just wanted to cut you down kind of thing.
Yeah, I guess, you know, they were a little bit older than me, and they're sort of, I guess, you know, being the age I was very intense, you know, sort of first to get there, last to leave, and I guess they were a little bit more casual about it. And, you know, that's just not the way I go about things. And I can understand that rubs people the wrong way if you're a little bit too intense or passionate, but certainly the bullying and the segregation and, you know, just the words that were said to me, I don't think any of my behaviour deserved that. And yeah, that's sort of the only reasons that they had stuff against me.
Yeah, right. And then the transition to running, talk us through that, like pretty late in your upbringing.
Yeah. So about 16, I remember I was driving with mum on the way home from a tournament. And yeah, I'd been starting to dabble in doing little runs here and there and doing LAC. And she sort of said, you know, would you be interested in, you know, would you want to do running instead of tennis? And I just had enough with tennis and what was going on within it. And just it felt like an escape to get away from it. And I did enjoy running. And then, yeah, I sort of just at 16 decided I'm going to try and have a crack at this and try and do, I guess, what I wanted out of tennis with athletics. Yeah.
Can you remember your first, like, hard training session you did or the first race when you were kind of 16 there?
Yeah, I think I did something with Frank Knott. He's a coach for North Launceston. He's an alderman, I think, or he was. And I got picked up in a TIS talent search and started training with Frank Knott. And, yeah, I struggled to begin with. I still hadn't started growing. Like, I'm pretty tall now. But back then, I was a bit of a short ass. And, yeah, I wasn't doing a lot of Ks or anything. So it really took me a while to get going. I was doing a lot of LACs and stuff like that. And you got Joshy Harris, who was running 3-minute Ks when he was like 16, and here I am trying to hold 3:30s and that sort of thing, you know, only a year younger. So it definitely took me a long time to adjust to athletics.
Yeah, but that's probably a good thing, isn't it? Like, just you didn't come in and smashing everyone first up. It's kind of you had to grind away and you had to work hard and sacrifice and commit to being a bit consistent with the training.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it certainly makes you want it more when you, you know, you're not sort of beating everyone. You know, I certainly wasn't. I think I did Simmons Plains. It was like a 6K cross country, and like I had high hopes myself, hoping that I'd make the state team that year. I think I ended up coming 7th or 8th, which was, you know, a little bit demoralizing to me. Like I'm probably a little bit, yeah, put a bit of pressure on myself, and I sort of thought I can just make the switch and come over and come out and get a medal or, you know, get top 5 and make the state team. But to come 8th, it sort of gave me something to work towards that next year, you know, yeah.
Can you remember some of your early PBs? Because I'll let the listeners know in a second what your PBs are at the moment, but I always enjoy hearing the stories of people who weren't naturally fast, didn't come through little athletics and actually have, you know, these kind of pretty mediocre first, second season personal best from back in the day.
Yeah. So early on, I think I did a Northern Champs, and I think I ended up running something like, it was for 3K, it was like 10:40 or something. So what's that? It's a touch over 3:30. So it wasn't great. And yeah. I think my 800 was about 2:20, and my 1500 was just under 5 minutes, I think. Yeah, nothing flash at all, mate.
Yeah, you've done well. I remember my first season, I was, 4:40 was my first ever race in a 1500, and then maybe like 9:56 for the 3K. So you were starting from further back than I was, and you've got me covered, I think, now over a lot of those shorter distances. So I guess just to give the listeners some context there, we'll just run through some of your PBs. Do you know them?
Yeah, so I think 800's 157. I probably shouldn't claim it as a PB, but I did it in the state champs 1500. So the last, I don't really race many eights, mate, but yeah, the last 800 of that was 157. I think Jimmy Hansen would have been about 155. So that's my 800. 1500, I think, is 3:52.06 or something.
Yeah, that's solid off that 800.
Yeah, so that, I was happy with that. I'd like to get it down a little bit lower, but yeah, 3K's 8:17. So that was when I won state champs a couple of years back with Josh and Jimmy. That was a good day for me that day. Like, based off what we'd done, and it was a really slow first K. I think we went through the first K in about 2:50 or something. So That was probably my favourite distance, I reckon, 3K.
Two big names to take down as well.
Yeah, I was happy with that because I mean they're both really close mates of mine, and they've had the better of me quite a few times. So I was happy to get the stick over them that day. They've both ran a lot quicker since, so I'll have to try and catch back up. Mm. 5K, I think I did it at Briggs. That was 14:23, it's not super quick, but considering I guess the training I'd done and stuff, it's not a bad time. And then 10, I think it's 30:58 at Runner Bridge.
Yeah, right. On a pretty hilly course, what we've already kind of spoken about. Hey, I reckon I can remember you running the Melbourne World Challenge one year as well. Did you run in that one?
I don't think so. Melbourne, is that a road race, is it?
No, like the Melbourne Track Classic I think it was called the Melbourne Track Classic then, maybe not the Melbourne World Challenge.
Yeah, no, that was a disappointing day. I think me and Josh were both pretty upset. We off Briggs, we qualified to do that. So we went in high hopes of running maybe like a 14:15 or something like that. But in hindsight, we looked back and we probably just dropped off our training a bit much. And I think I ran 14:44 and Josh was 14:45 or something. So a bit embarrassing because you've got these guys like Gregson and a few other guys that are, you know, running 13:40 and you're a minute behind.
That's right. Him and Brenton Rowe ran that night, didn't they? I'm trying to think who won it. I remember watching you guys in the stand and just like, because I maybe did it the year after or 2 years after, same thing, went to Briggs and ran a PB and then qualified for that. And then you pretty much run and try not to come last in that race.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. I think, no offense to Joshy, but I think we might have been, second last and last. So it was good just to beat him across the line for that one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I did the same thing with Matty Cox. We were both just banging out kind of 14:30 pace and then just sprint finish who wasn't going to come last. Because it's around the track as well, everyone can see you and you're just nearly getting lapped and, not much fun at all.
No, exactly, mate. Yeah, I don't think, I wouldn't head into a race like that again unless I was in sort of, low 14-minute shape because, it doesn't do too much for the confidence.
So let's maybe, you spoke about your training not being a lot, so maybe give the listeners a bit of context around what kind of a training week would look like back then.
Yeah, so I guess the majority of my problems, I mean, as we'll speak more about the drug use and stuff, I'm just not consistent. I'll sort of put in 3 or 4 really good months and then fall off the wagon or lose a bit of passion or that sort of thing. So I know that, knowing what I know now, running's really one of those sports where you've sort of got to have a few years behind you before you really start to see those consistent results and that consistent improvement. So I've never really ran more than 110K a week, which for the average person sounds like a lot. But as you know, mate, doing a marathon training and stuff, a lot of these top guys and mates of mine and stuff, they're all sort of, at a base trying to do 130, 140 and, higher, running twice a day most days. I guess because I've never had that consistent training, I haven't sort of been able to build myself up to that because, you can't just go out and start running 150Ks a week. You sort of got to get a little bit of a base, and I just haven't allowed my body to get that sort of that base. So hopefully this time around I can just go a little bit slower and get myself up to that more consistent training and start to see some, better results.
It's pretty crazy though, those list of PBs off no consistency and not a lot of training. It's a pretty good bang for your buck kind of amount of work you've put in to get those times out in return.
Yeah, I think, I'm a little bit maybe lucky, but when I do something, I get pretty full on and pretty intense about it and, I improve quite quickly, but then I sort of, bullet gate a little bit and, once I sort of get something, I sort of tend to throw it in. It's a little bit cut off your nose to spite your face. But, when I ran like 14:23 at Briggs, I think that was off about 5 months training, which is pretty good, really. I mean, my PB before that was 14:44, and that was when I think I was 19, and that was off. I'd had a year of training under my belt to do that. So I know that if I can sort of get 2 years together that, getting under 14 minutes certainly isn't unrealistic.
And then talk me through, year 12 rolled around, you finished high school. Pretty interesting time in everyone's life, isn't it, where you need a bit of direction and need a bit of routine. But what did that look like for Pat Smith?
Yeah, so I was doing year 13, I believe, at Newstead College, and I'd just come back from nationals up in Brisbane, and I got fourth in the overall race. I was first school age student, and then me and Jimmy Hansen both won the time trial. So that was like a really good running year for me, you know, to be up there. Like, I think they had a bad day, those boys, but like I beat Brett Robinson, who we all know how good he is, and, you know, guys like David Ricketts, who doesn't run anymore, but he was a great runner, and Kev Batt. I think I beat Kev Batt. So like to have a day like that and sort of be in the same, you know, league as them at that age, like I was, you know, that was a sort of where I really started to enjoy my athletics. And I ended up taking a job working for my coach's brother, who had launched a brand called Kahoo Running. So I'm not sure how they're going at the moment, old Kahoo, but back then they were a great shoe. And ended up working there, and then moved to Hobart to work in Kim Gillard's shop. Be under the guidance of him and start, like, I guess, what I thought at that time would be my running career down there.
So sacrificed a few things to kind of, not go to uni or not really concentrate on work and move towns to, the support of Kim would be pretty paramount, I'd think, and kind of you were really focused on chasing that running dream.
Yeah, I guess, you know, from a young age, I sort of, a little bit silly, but I remember telling my grade six teacher that I either wanted to be a professional tennis player at the time or a postie. So I'm a bit extreme. I'm either something, you know, sort of, a little bit unrealistic, maybe being a world number one tennis player, or happy just to be a postie. You know, I've never sort of had desires to be a doctor or a physio, or, you know, I guess that career path for me was always based around sport. And if it wasn't around sport, I'd sort of just be happy making a few coffees and serving a bit of food. So which really teamed well with running, I guess, the running lifestyle.
Yeah. So talk us through that time at the Running Edge down in Hobart.
Yeah. I mean, in hindsight, I probably wasn't ready to move away from home. I was 19 and I spent my 20th birthday down there, and I started to run pretty well. But once again, I sort of put all the eggs in the, if I'm not good in 5 minutes basket, I'll give it up. And I got injured, and I mean, I probably should have stuck at it a little bit longer. I had an injury that probably wasn't that bad, but I had a car accident a year earlier, and I think I had a dislocated hip or a green stick fracture. The MRI couldn't really tell, and I just had a lot of problem with that hip and a lot of weakness, and I was just struggling living down there, being away from the parents and some close friends. And I was really, in hindsight, grateful for the opportunity Kim gave, and I sort of wish I stuck it out. But I was only down there for about 6 months, I think, and ended up moving home, moving back to Launceston, not living with mum and dad. Once I'd moved out of home, I sort of, I guess, got the taste for living out of home and the benefits that come with that, you know, and sort of no set time to be home and, you know, sort of, I guess, no one to answer to. And then I started playing footy, which probably wasn't the right decision, just with that sort of lifestyle and the sort of things that go on in a footy club, I guess, with my personality. They didn't mix too well.
It's a pretty scattery 12 months there, isn't it? You know, moving houses, living in, you know, from home to away to home, but in another house, and a couple of different sports and a couple of different jobs. And the kind of writing's probably a bit on the wall that you're pretty vulnerable to start mixing into a different world.
Yeah, definitely. That was when I first started, using weed. It was something that was just done on the weekends after a footy match, or even sometimes the night before, and just a few mates that I had that, you know, for a lot of people, you know, they can take things like weed and alcohol, and, you know, they can have it once a week or once a month. But I pretty soon sort of discovered that I'm someone that can't do that. It sort of just became a daily way to deal with anything, really. And then there was, I guess, you know, a bit of drinking with that as well, just with the footy parties and, you know, drinking during the week with uni nights and stuff like that. And, found myself getting involved in that sort of stuff too regularly.
It sounds like that was your new thing, though. Like, you kind of talked about how you know, when you're in on something, you're fully in, and with running kind of not being there and footy kind of, do you reckon the footy was more of a social stuff? Like, were you playing seniors or just kind of doing it to be amongst the boys every weekend?
Nah, I mean, you know, to be honest, if any of the Hillwood boys listen, I probably thought I should have played seniors. They didn't pick me, so I'm a bit stiff about that, mate. But I played, I mean, we trained twice a week and then the game on the weekend, and I did all right. Like, I really enjoyed it. I loved playing. I was up at centre half forward, and like, I was, I think, halfway through the year. I missed the last six games of the year, but I was leading the best and fairest count and the goal kicking, and I was really enjoying it. Like, footy is something that, you know, I love to sit down and watch, and I enjoyed it. But I guess just the lifestyle with the drinking and the partying and that sort of thing, hindsight just wasn't the right sort of sport for me to be playing, really. Without running there and that sort of total commitment to training and eating and that sort of stuff that you have with athletics, footy, I sort of find you can party and get away with it, and you sort of got a few other blokes that can help you out if you're having a bad game. Whereas in running, you sort of, unless you put the training in, you can't run well. It just doesn't work that way.
Yeah, you're so exposed. There's no one who can help you out there when you're, you know, 4K into a 5K race or anything like that.
No, that's right. There's no one else to take over for you. That's, yeah, certainly true.
Yeah, so did you get over, obviously you got over that running injury if you were playing some pretty good footy, but never kind of went back to the athletics for a few years there?
No, I had, yeah, I would have been quite a few years off. And then I think I sort of finished up with the footy. I mean, once again, I guess being someone that's passionate at the time, I was vegetarian, now vegan, that doesn't really fit into a footy culture with barbecues and stuff. And when you're bringing along a potato salad with no meat and dairy and they're having a sausage sizzle and stuff, people are going to ask questions and stuff. And I just sort of, I just don't fit into that sort of, that sort of lifestyle that goes with it. And I found myself just sort of not enjoying the football club and that sort of thing. And I sort of started to jog again. This is probably maybe a year and a half later. I started to do a little bit of jogging and got myself pretty fit again and end up getting myself a girlfriend. And but then, you know, I'm also a bit like that. Like, I sort of had running and then new girlfriend came along, and so then the girlfriend sort of becomes, I guess, the drug. You know, running was the drug, and then, you know, I get a girlfriend, so then I sort of find it hard to balance the two, and then ended up getting some shin splints, and then so had a girlfriend, and then took another year off running. So, yeah, very patchy, mate.
Yeah, well, it seems that, doesn't it? Like, it just seems like, you're really into one thing, but you could really drop that at any minute and pick up something else really quickly.
Yeah, no, I sort of don't have a lot of consistency, and I've really struggled my whole life to have balance. I think Kim Gillard's been trying to tell me that since I was about 17. You know, it's about balance. It's about the big picture, but I can only sort of see 5 minutes ahead. So whenever something new comes along, mum calls me the chameleon, really. If I'm sort of with athletics, mate, I'm doing athletics. If I'm with druggy people, I'm doing drugs. And if I'm with people playing football, I'm a footballer. So, yeah, I guess through, you know, hindsight, I've said that word about 12 times today, mate, but with that, I think that's a lot of that problem has come through not feeling accepted with the stuff that happened with tennis and at school. And being someone that, I always wanted to fit in and feel accepted, as any young person does. And when you don't, you sort of find yourself trying to discover who you are. And I certainly, up until now, still don't really know who I am, mate.
Well, you're only 26 and far out. It's hard to get through that kind of, you know, 16 to 22 age bracket as it is, because so much is going on in your life and different chemicals through your brain, and you just do heaps of stupid stuff. But I can't imagine what it'd be like with that history of that bullying and I guess that breaking. Like, I had pretty good routine growing up, and it was still a difficult time for me, and you're not really sure who you are, and you're kind of searching for a bit of identity through there. But yeah, I just can't imagine what it'd be like for you.
Yeah, I mean, I've always had a really good family life, and some really close, you know, good mates, and I've had a lot of support from family. But, you know, there's only so much they can do. And when you're sort of an adult and you sort of, you know, you have to make your own decisions, your own choices, I guess with myself not having a lot of self-worth and self-confidence, I've just made a lot of stupid, irrational decisions that have sort of led me down the path I'm on now. And I hope now, I guess I was reading someone, they reckon that the guys don't grow up till they're 30. I think for me it might be 35, mate. But, I think now I'm slowly starting to mature, and, you know, there's certainly a lot of things that I'd change, but I think I start to feel now that I know who I am a little bit more and what I want, and, you know, that if the same, situations arise, I'd sort of have the ability to choose the right option this time around. So, yeah.
Did the choice to go vegetarian, was that a bit like that as well? You watched a doco and you just jumped into it full blown. But, you know, we're kind of talking about maybe 2011 here. Like, it's a pretty trendy and a pretty, hipster culture, and a pretty informed, with so many more documentaries and books on the benefits of being vegetarian and vegan now. So I'm really interested to hear why that decision came about back in 2011.
Yeah, well, it's actually the probably thing that I, it's probably the only thing I'm proud of myself for doing, because it's the only thing I've stuck at. Like when I did it when I turned 12, so I think Mum and I had spoken about it. Mum said she'd always wanted to do it, and I think I said to her like, "What? Why don't you?" And that sort of just sort of kickstarted this thing for us to sort of just look into, you know, I guess where meat comes from and what happens with the cruelty. And for me, it was never about health. I mean, there's a lot of stuff now that does talk about the health benefits, but I just sort of have the view that, you know, cats and dogs were once wild animals. I mean, we've domesticated them over thousands of years. And so to me, there's no difference between a cat, a dog, a fish, a shark, a pig. You know, they're all the same. And I mean, they're all animals that are wild, and we've chosen to domesticate some, and we sort of, yeah, I guess I call it speciesism. It's sort of a lot easier to get it mad at other cultures for eating dogs and cats when you're sitting down having a ham sandwich. So I just sort of feel that, it's just not something that I want to partake in. I don't feel like I could personally sort of sleep well at night if I was eating animals. And that's not to have a go at anyone else or say that they're in the, you know, they're in the wrong, or that I'm a better person or anything like that. It's just, it's my personal view. And yeah, it's just the way I feel about animals. Yeah.
So you've been doing that for like 14 years. How consistent are you?
Since I was 12, so as I said, probably the only thing I've been able to stick.
Consistency's there with the diet, but everything else has been a bit all over the shop.
Yeah, definitely, mate.
Okay, so we're up to this stage of your life where you've got this girlfriend, you put running on hold to be boyfriend of the year, kind of putting all the eggs in that basket. And I can imagine, as relationships do when you're in your early 20s, things don't turn out that well in the end.
No, so I mean, she was a nice girl, and you know, but we went our separate ways, and so then that ends, and I'm back on the running train again, you know, and I'm back training quite well again. And I guess with myself, like when I'm running well, I have a little bit more confidence about myself. As everyone knows, you go for a run, you get the adrenaline going and the endorphins, and yeah, I actually sort of met this other new girl a few months down the track, and then I was really, I guess, trying to balance the two, you know, training full on and having a job and having a girlfriend. And this particular girlfriend was a little bit younger than me, so there was, I guess, little bits of things to juggle with their parents and that sort of thing. But I'd been traveling all right, you know, but I think I got, yeah, it was getting shin splints, and the girl and I had been dating about 18 months, and I sort of running had started to fall off the wagon a bit. I think it was, yeah, a little bit after that Melbourne race, probably 6 months after that Melbourne race, I think I got injured, and I just, yeah, had a bad run at Lonnie 10. I think I got a stitch and ended up running 33 minutes or something. And just after that, things started to spiral again. And the girl being a lot younger than me, we didn't get to see a lot of each other. So I'd start to use weed on nights that I didn't see her and stuff. And just as a coping mechanism, it just became, you know, like if there was any problem with anything at all, I'd just go out and use weed, or, you know, go and party and drink. And yeah, soon, I guess I started to spiral out of control quite quickly.
So at this stage, it's still cannabis? Like that's the kind of drug of choice?
Yeah, that's it. I mean, I hadn't had anything else before that. It was just cannabis. And then the girlfriend and I had broken up through something silly that I'd done. I'd, you know, just lied about where I was and that sort of thing. And yeah, I'd taken on a job as a real estate agent, and that was quite full on to go from not knowing anything about real estate to sort of working full time 9 to 5 Monday to Saturday with no experience or, you know, course behind me. And I was really starting to, you know, just having the break up, and I really cared about this person, and then trying to balance a job and study to become a real estate agent. I kind of struggled with balance in general, as you've heard, mate, so those sort of things to balance just wasn't working. So I left that and started working in a hospitality job. And I was sort of, you know, smoking weed before and after work and that sort of thing. And then one of the gentlemen that worked there, he had actually, turns out, was an ice addict or an ice dealer from Sydney. And yeah, me and him had been smoking weed together, and he mentioned meth. And I mean, this was quite a few years back, so it was sort of before, I guess, what we know about ice and
before
and
Breaking Bad came out. We're talking that, yeah, before that,
well before that, mate.
I'm pretty straight. This is all new to me.
Yeah, no, I apologize to anyone listening. That's, you know, it's a bit full on, but
no, but I think it's going to be people are going to be curious as well. I've got some good questions, hopefully, to unpack it coming up. But yeah, sorry to interrupt.
Just cut me off whenever you want, mate, because I've got no filter, so I'll talk to the cows come home.
Breaking bad jokes, we'll keep those out of it from now on.
Yeah. No worries, mate. So I'd started using this particular drug with this gentleman, and as we know now with anyone that takes it, the first few times was just, insane, and no one should have it because the feelings it gives you and that sort of sense of power and love and feeling, like I sort of explained, it's sort of like having sex, finding out it's Christmas and it's your birthday and it's a public holiday, so you don't have to work all at the same time. Like, it's just this euphoria that you can't control. So after that, I think, I'd had it, and then 3 weeks later, I knew I had a really big problem, that I was in trouble, that I sort of couldn't live without it. So from there, it was quite a downhill spiral, using that and trying to work, and just the come down when you don't have it. I was very naive going into it. I didn't ask as many questions as I should. I just took it, and I didn't know enough about it. And, if I had my time again, I would never have touched it. It's just not worth these problems it's caused me now. Cut me off whenever you want, mate.
This is all interesting, mate. Keep going.
Yeah, no worries. So I ended up leaving that job, or actually I sort of got fired. The gentleman that got me involved, he got fired, and then 3 months later they let me go, just because I'd given up the ice, but I was still smoking weed, and so I sort of mutual sort of left, and then ended up moving to Melbourne to live with a mate, and sort of got myself, back on track. I sort of realized that, I am an addict and I sort of can't indulge in these things, and got my life together and ended up working at Adidas in Melbourne. So I'd probably been clean about 4 months by that stage. As silly as it sounds, I saw an ad where they're talking about banning sweet puffs, which is the pipes that people smoke meth out of at tobacco stores. And just seeing that ad, and seeing the film of the smoke in it, it just triggered. I went out and got some more. All of a sudden I was back doing it again.
Yeah, right. I guess the first question, because this is interesting for me, like I'm pretty straight school teacher, not really involved in this world, but how accessible is it? Like, even like with cannabis and now talking about meth, like obviously you can hit someone up in your phone and you could have some really quick kind of thing. Like, is it that easy to find on the street?
I can't speak for anyone that's done drugs, 20 years ago or anything like that, because I wasn't around then, but I can guarantee it's a lot easier now. There's apps on your phone where you can have secret messaging devices to contact people on the internet, and even in Launceston, I know where they live and what houses they live, and I could sort of go get it any time. And in Melbourne, it's even easier. It's on every corner, to be honest, mate. Go as far to say that ice is a lot easier to get than weed. There's been times when I was trying to get weed and that was harder to get than ice. So it's too accessible. It's almost scary. I mean, the average parent, I think if they knew how easy it was, they'd be, so concerned as you are, because it's such a horrible drug and it's way too accessible.
And it's quite hidden though, obviously. Like, if you're not looking for it, I know, even in our small town here, that's been in the newspapers about a problem, and it's kind of gone through small towns pretty rapidly and had some pretty devastating effects. But I always read the articles in the paper, and I just kind of, sometimes I don't believe it, because it doesn't seem like it's in front of your face, and you just don't really see it if you're not in those circles.
Yeah, no, I can understand that. I mean, if you're not sort of knowing what to look for, but I mean, yeah, like even Melbourne, like Southern Cross Station, that's a hot spot. That was where if ever I was heading to work, I worked down in, I should know. I worked there at Adidas DFO down in South Wharf.
Yeah.
So I'm really close to, Southern Cross Station, where I used to catch my train, and that were where I'd go in the morning to get it before work. A lot of train stations around Melbourne, just a lot of the suburbs where I lived in Caulfield South and Glen Huntly, and it's very quick. Obviously, it's like weed, they put a little bit in a plastic bag and it's a shake of hands, or it's a, leave it behind somewhere and you send them the money or whatever it is. It's very quick, it's very fast, and that's why, I'm sure it's so hard for the police to monitor and that sort of thing, because, it's not like a stolen TV where you've got to lift this heavy thing. It's, it's a drug and it's small and it's accessible quick, and it's pretty horrible when you talk about it like this. It's a bit embarrassing for me to even, be talking to you about it. I was certainly straight edge before I was you know, 19, 20 and would never have dreamed of, you know, being involved in this sort of world where, yeah, it's all these sort of horrible things happening on the daily.
But it probably shows just how addictive the properties of it are, that you go to these lengths to be walking through train stations to get hold of it. Have you got some, I guess, I don't know, the podcast called Tell Me Some Tales, but just how, you know, try to express just how addictive it was?
Yeah, no, very. I mean, I guess, you know, if you sort of tell someone that's a pack a day smoker that they can only have two cigarettes, they'd really struggle. So people, you know, as a nature are addicted, whether it be chocolate or coffee or cigarettes. But when it's, you know, an amphetamine, it's a drug that's made, you know, weed's addictive to the right people. I was just addicted to weed, I believe, as I am with ice or heroin or any other drug. But yeah, with ice, it's just, that euphoria, as I said, where you sort of have unlimited energy and confidence and happiness. And, you know, you could be told that you have to work a 15-hour shift and you'd be happy as Larry, you know. So it just becomes, it's almost like water, you know. You have to have it. You can't operate without it. And if you don't have it, you almost feel like you're not alive. So it's, you know, unless you've had it, you sort of, I guess, don't know how addictive it is. So by all means, anyone listening to this, don't go out and try it listening to me talk about it, because it's horrible.
Tell me a bit about the come down. Like you spoke about, like, obviously, if you're taking this stuff before work, your boss and that would know. Like, if you're acting in a way that everything's amazing and you're so almost over the top, like, how does that work?
Yeah, no, I mean, I can't speak for the people I was working for. I mean, a lot of people, I guess, listening to this now would probably, looking back, they'd see some of my behavior and think, yeah, there was something up. But, you know, I'd managed to function quite well. You're feeling these feelings, but you're trying not to portray them, if that makes sense. So, you know, when I started using it at this hospitality job, my prep work would take me 5 hours to cut up these veggies. You know, I started using ice and it took me 2.5 hours. So you just become, you know, you're thinking ahead of time, you know, your rhythm and whatever job you're doing, everything's, you know, ahead of time. You know, it's like you're almost seeing into the future and you're unlimited energy and you're just happy for no reason. I'm not saying you're walking around like you're on a mushroom trip or something. You're just very controlled. It's not like, I guess, weed, where it's that sort of slow, happy feeling. It's more of this, you know, what they say, it's, for anyone that knows about cocaine, it's sort of cocaine on steroids. It's you're very energetic and I think they probably might have known something was up, but it was nothing, I guess, that they could, you know, unless I had a drug test that they sort of, you know, would think to test me or anything like that. I wasn't behaving when I was on, I wasn't behaving inappropriately or anything. But certainly when you come down, you know, you lose all that enthusiasm and that energy and that motivation. And so you sort of go from someone that looks like they're giving 120% at work to being half-hearted.
Yeah, right. So would a normal day when you're using look like you'd get on, get a hit before work, go to work, power through, and then just as you're coming down, get another hit after work to get you through the evening? Or what was a general day like?
Yeah, pretty much, mate. You know, you'd have to have it before work. I mean, if you didn't have it at work, you'd just be a shit employee, really. There'd be no motivation. And you sort of take it just to get through the day and to enjoy work. And, you know, you would if you had it, but if you didn't, you know, it'd just be hell. And then at night, of course, you know, you want more if you can have it. But sometimes also you just want weed to come down. You know, that helps you. It calms you down. And then sort of save some if you had some for the next day. Because obviously when you have this drug, you can't sleep. You go 3, 4, 5 days at a time without sleeping. And so then when it's not in your system, you do turn into, I guess, what they call an ice zombie. You know, I can't condone any of these horrible stories about you hear people doing things, because it's just absolutely disgusting. The only thing I can relate to is knowing what they say by ice zombie, because you just, yeah, you're not yourself. You are walking dead because your body's so depleted.
What about cost and stuff, mate? Like if you're doing 2 hits of this a day, what kind of cost are we talking?
Yeah, I mean, depending on who you know, I actually, when I started first using it, I ended up getting a credit card to pay for it, which, I'll actually have finally paid off that credit card in 2 weeks.
So, good work, yeah.
So, I ended up getting a credit card just because, to pay for it, it isn't cheap. The prices vary, I guess, between states and that sort of thing. But, yeah, I guess a hit or a point, which is 0.1, that's like usually about $50, anywhere between 50 and 100. The more you buy, the cheaper it is. But, you know, I guess I almost would have had, you know, a $50 to $100 a day, you know, habit. And then you're racking up ticks with people and tell them you'll pay them back when you get paid. And so then when you do get paid, you owe money. And, you know, I had a credit card repayment as well. I had rent to pay. So then food money would go towards weed and ice, and so then I wasn't eating. And then, yeah, it's just, you know, you sort of looking back at it now, I sort of wonder why I'd even put myself through it. But you do, because you're addicted. So yeah, it's not a cheap hobby at all. It's you know, it's a waste of money. And yeah, you spend, you know, a ridiculous amount.
Yeah, it adds up over the week, doesn't it? If you're doing that every day of the week, you're looking at $700 pretty quick.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I couldn't afford $700 a week, so I'd buy $200 or $300 and try and make that last a week. And then if not, you'd rack up ticks or tell people you get them back, or, you know, I'd go and sell a pair of shoes, or I sold my computer at one point, I sold my bike, you know, all these little things that, look at it now, and I'm actually in my bedroom, and, you know, I've got my mum and dad's old TVs, and I had a much nicer one. I had a really good laptop. I had a nice bike. I have all these things that, you know, I've just thrown away all for something that disappears in, you know, a day or two. So it's, yeah, pretty silly behavior.
Yeah, well, I guess maybe just unpack what's the next step of life, because this doesn't sound real good, this living in Melbourne, going through this kind of doing this day in, day out, week in, week out, and kind of just heading terribly in the wrong direction, I suppose.
Yeah, so I ended up getting fired from Adidas. There was a video of me doing drugs at home, which I, you know, to be honest with you, mate, I don't remember doing it, but I did it with a friend, and it was myself smoking the drug and blowing a, you know, big thing of smoke, and I filmed on my phone, and I deleted the video on my phone, but it backed up over Wi-Fi, and someone whose phone I'd actually logged into on theirs, you know, so my email was on their phone. They actually saw the video on their email. They went to sign into their email and saw mine, and, you know, the old Google backup drive or the cloud or whatever they call it. And that person actually, yeah, sent the video to my boss and my boss's boss and my boss's boss's boss. So I'd actually had a couple of days, roster days off, and went back into work and got called in, and they showed me the video, and yeah, I was mortified, because I didn't believe that I'd sent it. But then at the same time, I thought, geez, I can't remember it, so maybe I did. So I thought that I sent it in. Found out it was actually someone that was close to me, and I was quite mad at them for quite a while. But, you know, looking at it now, had I not been doing the wrong thing, you know, they wouldn't have needed to do that, and they were just doing it because they cared about me. And yeah, so I ended up losing that job. And then, yeah, I was in real trouble, to be honest, mate. My lease was running out. I had no money because I had no job. I had no place to live. So I ended up becoming homeless for about 4 months. The place that I was getting my drugs from, I ended up staying there, and I was sleeping on a sleeping bag, and, you know, between that and the couch, between two different rooms, and yeah, living in a drug house, and yeah, all the things that go with that. It was just, yeah, it was horrible. In that short space of time, two people I knew committed suicide. There was three people that were hospitalized, two people that were arrested, you know, death threats, people coming around, people walking down the hallway with axes. And yeah, it was a nightmare. It was just, yeah, you sort of wouldn't wish it on your worst enemy.
Far out. And like, what's the relationship like with your family at this stage? Like, they couldn't just get you on a plane and get you out of there?
No, they did. You know, at that time, you know, I was still active addiction, you know, still using, even though I was hating the lifestyle I'd created for myself. You know, I still in my head sort of didn't want to give it up. You know, I hadn't had that, you know, they say you got to hit that rock bottom. I mean, even though I was seeing all these things, I still had drugs. So even though these horrible things were happening around me, as long as I had drugs, I could deal with it. And then, yeah, got to a point where the guy who's sleeping, floor I was sleeping on, he came home one night and shot up some heroin. And what happens if you have too much of that? You pass out and your body forgets to breathe. So he actually started to die in the room next to me, and couldn't hear him breathing, and I'm freaking out, and the other guy that lives there is freaking out, and, you know, we want to call an ambulance, but, you know, we know that the cops will come because there's drug paraphernalia everywhere. And so we had to roll him on his side and, you know, throwing cold water on him and whacking him on the face, and you sort of just got to kickstart their body again. And luckily he made it. But, you know, had he not, I guess part of that's on me. You know, that would have been on me. And just seeing that and seeing someone's face turn blue, their eyes not open and choking on their own saliva, that was when I really hit my rock bottom. And I rang up mum and dad and sort of, you know, said, can I please come home? I can't do this anymore. And, you know, they were more than willing to have me back.
Yeah, right. And what about, like, what are you, obviously not doing any running at this stage, but, like, what are you, where are you getting food to, like, yeah, eat and stuff like that? Or are you just motoring through, just this zombie?
Yeah, we're not mates. I mean, there's times where there wasn't enough toilet, you know, people, if they had a dollar left over, they wouldn't go buy toilet paper. They'd be trying to find $9 more to buy a butt of weed. So, you know, I was living off rice, pasta, bread. There was a little mission down the road that you could go, you know, once a fortnight to get like a little $30 Woolworths voucher. So yeah, I wasn't eating, to be honest, mate. I was gaunt. I was, had I been there, you know, a month or two longer, I probably wouldn't be talking to you now, mate, to be honest. Cause there was, you know, you don't feel like certainly eating healthy. And I was still, it's a bit strange. I was still pretty moral about not eating meat. So, I mean, they'd bring home sausages and stuff that people had given to them or vouchers that they got for a butcher and stuff, but I wouldn't eat that. So I ended up just, living on white bread and pasta and rice. And certainly nothing nutritious about the way I was living.
Yeah. And, like, did you ever jump on some scales? You wouldn't have been weighing much, would you?
No, I didn't. We didn't have any scales in the house. If there was any, I'm sure they would have been sold.
So, someone would have sold them, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm not sure. I wouldn't. I mean, I'm about 6'3", so at the moment, like, I weigh about 72 kilos. But yeah, I wouldn't have been much more than probably 62-63 kilos. I don't reckon. Hard to say, but I was definitely skinny and malnourished.
Did you have, you know, sometimes you see on the ads, like, all the scabs and stuff that people have, and just in the advertisements about the dangers of ice? Like, were you pretty scabbed up?
Nah, pretty lucky, I guess. I'd started to get like pimples and breakout because when you take it, your heart rate increases, so you're sweating and you know, they say that, you know, you sort of smell a bit because you're sweating and then you get pimples and those pimples turn to scabs because you're scratching. And after I lost the job at Adidas, I actually started using drugs intravenously, so with a needle and using ice and heroin and cocaine. And when you're using it intravenously, you're still sweating and that sort of thing, but it's not as much, so you're not picking at your face. I guess it'd more be at your arms and that sort of thing. And pretty lucky that I didn't get that sort of thing, because I have seen some of the photos, and mum used to tell me, you know, look at the stuff that's in it and look at the photos of how you look. And you know I sort of didn't want to, because I knew how horrible it was. But I was pretty lucky to get away with not getting that. I had bad skin for sure. I was getting pimples, but didn't get, I guess, those holes in the face and stuff that you see that some people are, you know, that get that are using.
Yeah, right. So that SOS call goes home, and you're home pretty quick after that, and life's back on track. Or what happened next?
Pretty quick. Mum had sort of said to me, you know, that obviously I came back home, I couldn't use. You know, this is their house, and you know, they're really against drugs. You know, they've known people that have been involved in it, and it's been horrible, and they didn't want me coming home unless I was willing to give it up. And you know, at that time I had no job, so I jumped on Centrelink, and mum said, you know, once that first pay comes through, if you can keep it, you know, book a flight home. I actually ended up owing a drug dealer, and the guy whose floor I was sleeping on, he owed as well, so I ended up that first week paying for him, you know, and myself on what we owed. So then I couldn't fly back that week, so then obviously, you know, Centrelink pays fortnightly, so the next fortnight comes around and, you know, got no money, got no drugs, can come home, but the addiction's still there. And yeah, I didn't come home because, you know, I couldn't wait. You know, I had to have the drugs. So I ended up, you know, purchasing drugs again. So it sort of took me, it's about 6 weeks to get home after that really big rock bottom, even though I knew I didn't want any more. You know, it sounds, for anyone listening, I probably sound like an absolute idiot, and I can understand why, but yeah, that addiction is still so powerful that, you know, you sort of give up even that opportunity to come home just to score one last time and that sort of thing. So it took me sort of about six weeks, I think, to finally book that flight and come home.
When I said it took me 6 weeks to get back from Melbourne, and that in that 6 weeks, you know, I had opportunities to fly back earlier if I was able to book my own flight, but, you know, I couldn't. I was that consumed by the drugs, and I couldn't even wait or go 48 hours without drugs, you know, to enable myself to book a flight. And in the end, mum ended up having to book a flight because she could just see that I wouldn't come home if it was under my own steam. I was just, you know, that lost and that gone. And even when I came back and I got myself back on track, you know, and then I fell off the wagon again, I got to the stage where I wanted mum to give up on me. I wanted to go back to that lifestyle because it's a lot easier to give up and go back to that than to work hard and to keep trying to get off drugs. And I guess that's why they're so addictive. And, you know, I begged her at one stage to give up on me, and she never gave up, not once, you know. And if it wasn't for her and that belief and the keep on trying and trying different things, and, you know, I don't think I'd be here today.
And what was it like jumping on that, you know, Jetstar, Tiger, Virgin, whatever the airline was, out of Tullamarine there? Did you feel like it was just a massive achievement to get out of there?
Just relief, really, because, yeah, as I said, the things that I'd seen and the events that had transpired over that sort of last 4 or 5 months, you know, I just felt relieved to be home, you know. But that being said, I'd been using drugs up until the day that I left, so there was a long process ahead of me as far as, you know, trying to detox. And, you know, I hadn't been able to go without drugs for that 4 or 5 months, you know, with everyday use. So I was scared as well, definitely scared and worried, I guess, of, you know, people are going to see me back home and, you know, how things were, because, you know, mum was, you know, happy to have me home, but at the same time she had a lot of things going on in her life with, you know, her mum being sick and other family members that she needs to care for. And then this, I guess, sort of big battle with me, because I, you know, it's not like I can just come home and just continue on with life. There needs to be rules. Like, I wasn't allowed to have a phone, you know, for obvious reasons. I could go out and get drugs, and wasn't allowed to go out at night because, once again, you know, obvious reasons. And so, you know, mum sort of had to become not just my mum, but I guess, you know, my banker, my jail warden and all that sort of thing, which no parent should have to do to their 26-year-old son. But she was willing to do all that to try and help me. So at the same time, I was relieved, but definitely scared.
Mm. So did you sit down with her and kind of, you know, make it real black and white? These are the rules. I need to get through this, and she's in charge, and doesn't matter what happens, it's mum's way or the highway kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, she sort of said that, you know, if you don't give them up, and if you slip up, then, you know, you'll be back on a plane back there, because, you know, as much as, you know, she cares for me, I'd sort of, you know, this drug thing hadn't just been happening in Melbourne. It happened in Launceston before I went to Melbourne, and the drug use had been happening before, I guess, I'd even started using ice. So mum had seen these patterns of me being addicted, and I guess myself not wanting to admit it or wanting to give it up. So, you know, even though she would have hated to have to do it, she sort of said that, you know, if you don't get yourself clean, or if you still continue to go out and use drugs while you're living here, because, you know, I had nowhere else to go, literally nowhere else to go, and no money, that, you know, I would have to leave. So I'm sure as a parent, that's, you know, an absolutely horrible thing to have to think about doing. But, you know, we did have rules in place that she made and that I had to adhere to. Yeah.
Yeah, right. So what is it, we talking like last year, Pat? What kind of timeline are we up to?
Yeah. So I'm trying to think. So what we around the bridge was January. So I think I came back of June the year before that. So what's that? That makes it 2015?
Yeah. So yeah, you were pretty much on back, you know, getting on the rails until, yeah, mid last year, 2016 to, yeah, start of 2017 when Run the Bridge happened and you smashed me, pretty much.
Yeah. So I think, I mean, even between that, I did have, you know, a few slip-ups, and I'd love to say that I came back and that everything's been fine and dandy, but, you know, that's not the case. And, you know, you've got to keep sort of trying. Addiction's not something that you just decide, okay, we'll give it up today, and then you're fine for the rest of your life. You're going to have slip-ups. And I did slip up a couple of times. You know, mum was, as she said, if I made a mistake, she'd send me on a plane, but she didn't, because she's a lovely lady. So, mum, if you're listening to this, thanks heaps. But, yeah, I slipped up, you know, quite a few times, and then got myself about 4 months clean, I think, and that was, the 4 months was probably a month after Run the Bridge, I think. And then I had that race, Run Devonport, where I, you know, it was actually a pretty good run, really, but being hard on myself, I sort of, yeah, just got a bit upset and ended out going out and buying some weed, and yeah, started to go downhill again.
It's going back to that tennis kind of stuff, though, isn't it? Being hard on yourself and having these huge expectations. And I think we weren't recording when we spoke about that Run Devonport race, but you went down there after a pretty good result at Run the Bridge, where you know, broke 31 minutes for a pretty hilly 10K and expected to win. But Tassie's pretty loaded with some pretty good athletes, and you had a good battle, but they got the better of you on the day.
Yeah. And I mean, sort of when I think about it now, it's a little bit disrespectful to Dylan. He's someone that puts in a lot of effort, and he's been running for quite a few years consistently, and he's had some good results. And I guess for me, just to sort of think I can come out after 4 months and beat him, and I guess the reason I thought that, we'd had a few sessions a couple of weeks earlier, and I was beating him in the session. So then my mindset is, okay, I'm going to win this race. And then when I didn't, it was this big letdown. But it's a little bit mean to him because he deserved it. And he beat me by about 8 seconds or 10 seconds. So really, the positive should, I should be thinking, well, that's good. You've had all this time off and you're only 10 seconds behind him. But it wasn't like that. It was like, oh, you're not better than him. You're a loser. And throw in the towel and we start all over again.
Yeah, because Dylan's in pretty good shape. Launceston 10, I think he broke 30 minutes. I'm not sure if it was that year, but he's definitely gone under 30 at Launceston 10 before. So we're talking about a quality athlete, and you're so hard on yourself after getting rolled by him by 8 seconds, as you said.
Yeah. So I just sort of, I look back at it now, and I guess my mindset's changed now that, and that's why I guess I'm not trying to do any races at the moment, because, I do want, immediate gratification. And, if I sort of, get myself reasonably fit after 4 months, I certainly want to try and start racing. But this time around, I think I'm just going to have a bit of build up, and I might do a little race in Hobart at the end of the month, and I'll try and do Run the Bridge this time around. But I guess the mindset now is just that, I know what my thinking does. I've had control of my own thinking for a long time, and it hasn't served me well with all the stuff that I've done. So I'm trying to take on other people's advice and just take things slow and try and enjoy the process rather than the destination. And that's something that's really hard for me. But just doing it now for these last 3 months, I'm starting to see the benefit already. So I'm hoping I can continue it.
It's I could connect in a way, and not in any similar way, but just a small connection. When you have a bad run and you might buy a six-pack of beers afterwards, or you might go past a servo and stop in and get a Maxi Bon or a pink donut or something like that. I know I do all these kind of similar things all the time, and I think a lot of the runners listening will. I think when you have good experiences as well, sometimes you treat yourself with a bit of a reward to, have something that's not so good for your body. But I guess when your thing's so addictive, it kind of just spirals out of control straight away. Whereas I know I can have my Maxi Bon or have the strawberry donut, and it's not going to just throw my life upside down pretty much immediately.
That's right, yeah. And I think I used to rent a house with a lady I'm sort of friends with. I got offered a job by her, which was really nice. But, she was our landlord, but she was also our neighbour. And, I'm sure there would have been many mornings she'd see me wake up and go outside and have weed, and then 15 minutes later she'd see me going for a jog, and I'm sure she must be like, what's this guy doing? Like, it just, I am a bit, I guess, schizo. There's sort of two voices in my head, the voice that says you need weed to have a good day, and then I guess I'm sort of feeling guilty, so then I go out for a run. And yeah, a lot of sort of just silly behavior. And yeah, as you said, like, it'd be much more beneficial to have a bad run and just to go out and have a little bit of junk food or have some hot chips or something. But for me, the first thought is, I need this thing that's sort of, I guess, being my best friend that, I had when I sort of felt like I had no one else, or, my way to deal with things became drugs. So when something goes wrong, that's the first thing I turn to, which, it hasn't served me well.
Tell me a bit more about the support. So obviously your mum's played a crucial role in that, but were you speaking with counsellors or, rehab kind of facilities, or what was happening?
Yeah, I mean, when I was in Melbourne and I first lost the job and started using, drugs heavily and needles and stuff, I did try and look at rehabs, but they are quite expensive. I mean, there's a few that are government funded and they sort of take 6 months to get into. So if you're already sort of in trouble, you sort of can't wait 6 months. So that was why the option, I guess, to come home and just sort of try and do like a home rehab at home. So, no phone and no going out at night. And, mum would obviously have control of my money and stuff like that. So that, I guess, was my form of rehab, was being at home. I did try a few counsellors and stuff, but a lot of them are, I guess, drug preventatives. And at that point, I didn't need, prevention, because I knew I can't keep using, so that wasn't really super helpful. I did see a psychiatrist, but he wasn't I just didn't find, like, I connected with him that well, so I sort of found it hard, I guess, to open up, and so I didn't find that any of those outlets worked. I guess what's sort of changed this time was, as horrible it is, but seeing what my nan went through and being there when she passed away, it sort of just you know, widen my eyes to how short life is, and if I keep doing what I'm doing, I'm not going to have much of a life or a life at all. And so is really what I'm doing, and the hurt I'm causing other people and friends, and, you know, is it really worth doing this to myself as well, just for drugs?
Mm. And now let's move on to, I guess, the low-key running approach. Like you said, you don't want any races that are going to give you that instant gratification. I don't think you're on Strava, are you? You on there?
I jumped off because once again, being pretty addictive, I was sort of checking out like it was Facebook or Snapchat. I was, you know, looking at it all the time and seeing what the good guys are uploading and try to model my sessions around that. And if they're doing a warm-up at 420s, I'm doing a warm-up at 420s. And if they're doing 8 by K, I'm trying to do 8 by K, you know, and just stuff like that. That became an addiction as well. So, yeah, I'm not on it. I mean, maybe in the future once I'm a little bit more, you know, together, but probably not actually. I think at the moment it's just definitely something that the best I sort of go about things is when I treat things low-key and I sort of cut out anything that could be addictive. I'm just, yeah, addictive by nature, whether it be, you know, with a relationship, with a drug, with a sport, with a phone. I think I just sort of cut myself off that one for a while.
Mm. Well, I guess you could see what those pros are doing, and, you know, you could bang out the same session, then you get home and check what they've hit for their splits, and you're 5 seconds a K slower, and then, you know, you get a bit depressed about it. You think you're not doing the right stuff, and, you know, these are kind of triggers for you that could lead to who knows what.
Yeah, that's right. Like, I remember talking to Benny St. Lawrence in Hobart, and he said, "Are you still on the plant-based diet?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm trying to get off some plants, mate." Like, you know, because it was a bit of probably a poor tasting joke, but you know, like, I just, even, you know, a few weeks before Run the Bridge, I was smoked weed, you know, and then, you know, after that I was fine for 4 months, but then, you know, it slowly creeps in, just that I guess that, you know, the thing on your shoulder. And yeah, I have no balance. So for me, I just sort of have to cut all those sort of behaviors out altogether. And yeah, just sort of take a really simple minded approach towards it. And just sort of, yeah, I don't think I've ever actually done running for me. It's always been about trying to prove to someone, or, you know, oh, if I do this, I'll get in the paper and people will love me, or, you know, someone that might have said something bad about me, they'll like me now because I'm winning this race. So it's never really been about me, which, you know, we all know sport should be. It should be about fun. It should be about enjoyment for the individual. And yeah, I don't think I've really enjoyed it since I first made that switch to when I was 16.
Yeah, right. And obviously you're back working now. I know you're working this morning. I think we touched on that at the start of recording here. So, you know, the routines are back in place and you're feeling like everything's going to be successful from here on in?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to make any promises because I've tried them before and you end up letting yourself and more people down. But as I said, with the events that transpired recently, it's just sort of opened my eyes up. And, you know, my mindset was that, you know, if I can't make the Olympics or a Commonwealth Games or make a career out of running, I'll just be a drug addict, you know, and that sounds completely stupid and I know it, and people would be thinking that's just, you know, a silly attitude. But that was just where my head was at, that if I couldn't have this highest level, that I'd just, you know, be, you know, a really poor version of myself. Whereas now, you know, I might have missed the boat. I might not ever make a Commonwealth Games or Olympics, but, you know, I can do athletics as a sport. You know, there's a lot of benefits that come with it, health and, you know, social relationships. And yeah, I've just tried to take that medium level approach where, you know, I can get enjoyment and it's about me. It's not about trying to prove anything to anyone. You know, I look at someone like Jake Birtwistle, who probably looked up to me when he was younger, and now I'm looking up to him. And, you know, he sort of had all the same opportunities as me and he took them. And, you know, he'd give up the party lifestyle. He'd be in bed probably early and, you know, I'd be out partying or scoring drugs. And, you know, you just look at the two ways those lives have gone. He's made a career out of triathlon, and, you know, I probably could have had, I can't swim, so I wouldn't say I'd be a triathlete, but probably could have had a more successful running career than what I've had, you know, this far. And, you know, I've chosen that sort of wrong option and that wrong way to deal with things. And so, yeah, now I just don't want to go back there. I guess when I first got myself clean, I still felt like I wanted drugs, you know, even though I knew I couldn't have them, I still wanted them. Whereas my mindset now is like, I really don't. I hope that stays that way. But the thought of it just, you know, I guess I think about the consequences and what it'll do if I take it, and how I have to start all over again and letting people down, letting myself down, and, you know, going back into that world where, you know, you're not sleeping at night, you're sleeping on the floor, you've got people in your house that are, you know, got axes and sleeping with guns under their bed, and it's just, yeah, it's just not something that, you know, I ever want to go back to. And yeah, I just want to sort of have a normal life. You know, I've never been normal. I'm very extreme. I'm either really high or really low. And yeah, I guess now, just with everything that's happened, I've sort of hopefully, it's opened up my eyes to just, yeah, being content with just being me and whatever I can do, not trying to compare to myself to others.
And that balance is important, isn't it? Like, I know you just touched on Olympics at Commonwealth Games, but I'm sure there's a lot of people that put all their eggs in that basket. They get to those highest heights and they, you know, run at that highest level or throw or jump or whatever sport it is. But then they come home and I'm sure it's pretty depressing. They might not have a university degree or a full-time job or a family or, you know, little involvement in their community. So when that retirement in that sport comes or when you come back from those major championships, I'm sure they feel similar with that balance.
Yeah, exactly. I can completely relate to that. Not making that level of competition, but the feeling of, you know, you've got nothing after you've sort of put your eggs in that basket. And yeah, I guess that would be something I'd have to be careful, you know, of if I was able to get myself a little bit better at running, that, you know, I didn't set this goal for this particular race. And then when that race is over, you know, fall back into that trap. So I can definitely relate to that. And I think now I'm just trying to build a lot of other things in my life and have balance. And so that way, if something happens, like I get injured, you know, I've got other things to turn to, whether it be friends or a different hobby or put my focus into work. So yeah, I guess finally I feel like just with what I've learned over all these years and all the silly mistakes I've made, that, you know, if something did happen or a problem arise, that, you know, I've sort of got that ability to sort of focus and put myself on the right track rather than the wrong.
Mm. Well, you got it early as well, didn't you? Like, it's 26, you still got a few years ahead of you to sort things out and be successful in your 30s.
Yeah. I mean, I sort of do get worried. You sort of like start looking in the mirror and there's a few wrinkles on the forehead. And I mean, anyone older than me would be thinking, oh, you're young as anything. But, you know, I have sort of wasted the last 8 years of my life. You know, my mindset was, oh, I've already wasted eight, so I'll just, you know, continue doing what I'm doing. But, you know, now with, I guess, the changes that have happened and things like that, you know, I'm quite lucky. It is only 8 years that I've wasted. I've met people that have the same problem as me, and they didn't get themselves together till they were 39 and 40 and 50, and, you know, they've wasted more time than me. So, you know, the quicker I do it, the more better and beneficial life I'm going to have. So yeah, hopefully, as my coach would say, plenty of time. So yeah,
patience, that's the big thing with distance running as well, isn't it? Time, patience and consistency.
Yeah, you can't spell patience without Pat, but apparently in my head you can.
Yeah, right. Hey, mate, what I always finish off with is the same question. I always ask the guest if they've got a mantra or a quote or a philosophy that they try and live their life by. And I can imagine that you've probably had more than one in the past, but where's that stop now? Have you got something that you kind of try to relate to pretty often?
Yeah, I think probably the big picture. That would be, you know, my mindset, you know, not thinking about just that short term goal, but think about the big picture and what you want for the future. So I guess, yeah, that'd be mine at the moment, mate.
Yeah, beautiful. And you know, you've kind of spoken about social media and kind of keeping a low profile, but if people want to keep track of your journey and kind of throw their support your way, what's the best way to do that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm on most of them. I've got my social media privileges back. I probably upload too many photos, so I apologize to anyone that's friends with me and getting sick of my vegan food or my coffees that don't look too good. But it's, yeah, Paddy, PADDY _2345 on Instagram and just Patrick Smith on Facebook. So if they want to contact me, feel free to.
Beautiful, mate. Thanks for your time afternoon. Thanks for being so open, and thanks for being so, yeah, I guess it's pretty vulnerable to put yourself out like that. And yeah, really appreciate that you made contact to come on the show, and yeah, we've finally been able to make it happen.
Nah, no worries, mate. Thanks so much for having me, and I look forward to seeing you in February down Hobart.
Yeah, well, I think I might be even in, might be there mid-Jan with Cadbury.
Oh.
I'm trying to get down for, yeah, maybe get down for something down there and do a bit of a podcast show around it, and yeah, trying to sort a few things out at the moment.
Nah, perfect. Well, I think I'm actually in Ethiopia then with a mate, but yeah, we'll touch base before then anyway, mate.
Oh, let's get you back on after that, talk about the experiences in Ethiopia.
No worries, mate. Pleasure.
Thanks, mate. See you later.
Have a good one. Bye.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.